The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
You're a fucking retard.
That's not PC.
You think I give a shit about PC? We're gonna die out here. Do you get that, you piece of shit? We're going to die, and it's your fucking fault. Your life is over. My life is over. We are gonna freeze to fucking death in the fucking freezing tundra, and it's your fucking fault. That's how you play sassy.
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Loose Cannons coming at you. It's me, I'm Ruben, I'm back. Sorry that I missed last week's crossfire, but unlike what you may have heard, it wasn't because I just didn't feel like it. It was a social experiment in anti-Semitism. Took the one Jew off the podcast to see if anyone noticed, and the answer is no one did, because no one notices anything on this podcast. No one cares. Joke delivered just as well a second time.
Yeah. Even better this time.
Speaking of things that always work, today we're going to be discussing 2016's Always Shine, directed by Sophia Takal, who is, like me, a fellow graduate of Vassar College, and I thought it might be fun to Vassar up this podcast, so we're bringing on a guest host you may remember, my friend from college and filmmaking partner at the time, Colin Snow.
Hi. Hey, Colin. Hi, thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
Thank you for coming on, as always. And Colin will be replacing Basil today, so that means that Patrick and Ilya are the other two people joining us.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey. Due to the technical difficulties that I just sort of hinted at obliquely, we're going to move heralds and denouncements to the end of the podcast because Ilya's in more of a rush than he originally planned.
And
he has time to participate in them. That's great. But instead, we're just going to jump right into Always Shine, and then we will do heralds and denouncements at the end. So stick around for that. But Always Shine was my pick, and the plot is this, which is it's about two like mid-20-something actresses named Beth and Anne at different points in their career path. One is very moderately successful, but not like a big name or anything. She's maybe just been offered her first feature part, and then the other one is not hardly successful at all, and is struggling to make ends meet and seems to be living a much rougher life. When they agree to go on this vacation together to one of their aunt's like nice home in Big Sur to like reconnect and hang out, and the tension caused by the differences, I guess, in their places right now in life eventually boils over to where they have a big fight that leads to a physical altercation, and then it's the next day and we've got kind of a Mulholland Drive body switch thing happening that's not 100% explained, and then we sort of get to see one of them kind of live life as the other one for a little while, and then the movie just sort of ends, really. There's not a lot of plot, so I hope that I summed it up pretty well. But yeah, Patrick, what did you think of this movie?
I liked this movie. I would say I didn't love it, but I really thought that the construction of it was pretty good. I think it's very well shot, and I really like the way that a lot of the scenes are laid out. A lot of the times it's simply just shots of the actresses' faces reacting to something happening off screen, which I think is a fun way to shoot sort of a horror film. I guess you could classify this as a horror film. I guess in the same way that David Lynch sort of gets lumped into horror films in a way. Psychological horror for sure. But yeah, I also like the way that it courts microaggression as this sort of like banal horror of everyday life for these two actresses. And I enjoyed the deft hand that was applied to that bit of the film.
So, Colin, we went to Vassar, mm-hmm. and we were friends then, and I was just wondering mm-hmm. whether or not this movie spoke to you at all concerning our friendship.
Yeah, but who's who? Oh, no.
I think you're the mildly more successful one.
Just, like, filled with shame and discomfort at everything that she has to do in her career. Yeah, yeah. Could be. Yeah.
I'm like this close to murdering you.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. So yes, many echoes of Ruben and my relationship, of course. I also from what you said, Patrick, I also liked it. I really wanted to like love it. I have to say, I think that it is the kind of movie that is like my favorite kind of movie, in that like I love like psychological horror, like the thing you were just defining. I love like female rage. I love I even love sort of like it's like budget and like it's like kind of moodiness. I don't know, all that's like kind of some of my favorite things, and I don't think it quite got to like great status. There were like a couple things I guess kind of missing, I felt like, from it. But that said, still super enjoyable. Really like that up close, like very tight, like close up shooting that it really relied on, I thought worked really well, just in the camera work, but also those actors were good enough, like they really could make it interesting when it's like up close. So I thought that was cool. I liked the music. I liked the setting was awesome. And in general, I really liked it. Yeah.
I was pretty middle of the road about this one. I think I liked the fact that it had like these absurdly small stakes that like escalated to a complete like total huge thing. I liked the fact that these weren't like famous actresses. It was just like kind of like struggling actresses, one more struggling than the next one, and yet on that level it's actually more true that most people don't deal with like each other's success like on like a magnified basis. It's mostly like smaller things, and yet you're kind of still, I don't know, like a lot of people still feel like envy towards their friends when they're even like mildly successful and start questioning their own selves about it. So I thought that was pretty true to life. I also like the movie that I immediately came to mind when I was watching this was Queen of Earth, like Alec Ross Perry's Queen of Earth. And I like this definitely a lot better. I think the fact that that one was made by a dude and this one was not made by a dude, like,
well, this
female
one was written by a dude.
Yeah, it's like there's like something about like the friendship that in Queen of Earth felt like super snide and like very backstabby like from the beginning, whereas here it's like they're just incredibly confused about their relationship with each other, and like there is some like level of warmth there, but it's just very quickly kind of done with. And so I just thought that there was like nothing particularly super memorable about this movie at the end of the day, so I don't know if I'm gonna revisit it anytime soon, but like I thought it was decent.
As far as horror films that have cameos from Colleen Camp to hint you into their knowledge of film history, I'm going to go with Knock Knock as my far preferred film of the two. I'm there pretty much with Ilya. I thought it was fine. There are parts that I enjoyed. parts that I didn't, as the kids are saying these days. I thought it was a little too extra. everything was like a little just like too much, like most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, the intercutting titles, the acting, like you won't hear me say this that often, but it's like an 87-minute movie that really needed to be like 30 to 40 minutes longer, because it doesn't like build up mm-hmm. a lot of things. Like, it just sort of like jumps to moments, and like the scenes that I feel like play out in more real time, or at least emotional real time, like when the older dude at first is hitting on I'm gonna get their names
Anna at it's first so
poor. Yeah, he's hitting on Anne or Anna at first, and then like she's too aggressive for him, and so then he switches to Beth, and then and sees them and gets really upset about that. I thought that scene was really, really good, and
yeah.
I really liked the dynamic shifting that went on in that scene. But then, like, you know, one of the very next scenes is like Beth like flipping out on the phone to her boyfriend about how much Anna hates her, and I was like, I don't feel like I'm there yet. And I have to admit, like, you know, I thought that Caitlin Fitzgerald and Mackenzie Davis, I think are the name of the two leads, I thought they were fine, but I really like Sophia Tocol as an actress, and I was actually kind of sad that she wasn't in this one. I watched a bunch of her films over this week, I guess, in preparation, and she's really good in a lot of stuff, like especially Wild Canaries, which we talked about on the Best of 2015 podcast. But yeah, I thought it was fine. I would be willing to revisit it at some point, because I don't know. There's definitely more there, but it felt, yeah. Overall rushed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One actress, Mackenzie. What's her name?
Davis.
Mackenzie Davis.
That one I'm sure of.
Yeah, she's
the other one. I'm not.
She's gonna be in Blade Runner.
She sure is. Oh.
Just really funny.
Which one was she in the movie?
Oh, she's playing. Yeah, like
she's the one who's Anne. Like the main girl. She's Anne, and then Anna. She switches to Beth.
Right,
she's Anna in this movie. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. And she's playing the Daryl Hannah character in Blade Runner, right?
Well, sure. Sort of. Both of strong chins. Yeah.
Oh wait, the Blade Runner is not a. It's not a remake.
It's not a remake. No.
It's a sequel.
It's a
sequel.
Yeah.
As I was like, oh, she's definitely playing that like that replicant role.
Yeah.
She's got the look for it for sure. But yeah.
No, it's just funny in terms of like scale. Obviously, like this movie really.
Yeah, that's the way things are working these days.
But I mean, I agree with Patrick. You know, having watched a bunch of these, like all from this similar group of people, like, oh, until this one, almost all of them draw from the same like stock actors, like Caitlin Shiel, and the guy who appears in this one for a little bit, his name is Jesse in the movie.
Yeah.
Lawrence Michael.
Yeah. He's the writer.
Levine.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Writer. He's also her husband. And he wrote and directed Wild Canaries and Gabby on the Roof in July, which I know Patrick has also seen. This one looks very different from those. This one has a lot more static shots, a lot better lighting and color correction. And I thought this was a very, very nice looking film, the best looking one of the group that I watched for sure. There's a lot of those shots which appear in David Ehrlich's Best of 2016, which was the first time I heard about this movie, of like the lava and stuff like that, like shooting into the air and stuff like that. That I think are super cool looking shots.
I agree. I actually really wished, so like I'm totally with you, Ruben, that it should have been longer, because like they missed all these, that's what I felt like they just like didn't pull it along in the right speed and all this stuff. But I was actually thinking, like, I liked the part, you know, like the last half hour where she's like imitating her friend, like at the risk of being too Mulholland Drive-ish, which I don't even like Mulholland Drive that much, so I don't know why I wanted this. Yeah, but I really wish that had been most of the movie. Like, I wish that they'd done the first hour like somehow just like really quick, and then the whole rest of the movie had been, because I thought that like the shooting kind of changed a little bit, it was shot a little more dreamy, you know, there were more intercut shots of like sort of like beauty that like mixed in with like the weird muted stuff that was going on screen that was always a backdrop to her, like what was clearly affecting her. And I really thought that was the most interesting part of the movie, and the whole first part I liked, but then I wished when that second part hit that, like, it had been less or something.
I don't know. I liked Mackenzie Davis's performance as Beth better than her performance as Anne, actually, yeah. as well.
Mm-hmm.
It felt more layered, whereas her other... Yeah. At the beginning of the film, like, she was...
Too sassy.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, like, in that read-through scene where, like, maybe we kind of understand why she hasn't been as successful, because she's, like, really, like, hitting it, like, really hard. Like, she's not providing really... Beth has been offered this dumb horror script that maybe she doesn't even want to take, but it's a feature role, and it's the first time either of them have been offered a lead role. And they, like, run the script together, and then they switch parts, and then Anne is obviously just using the script as a sounding board to yell at Beth the second time they run it through. And I felt like there actually wasn't that much difference between her performance there and her performance as the character in general. And that she was a lot more interesting when she was playing, like, all the different layers of, like, you know, mm-hmm. being Beth, but also having something underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I just really liked how weird the storyline is that she, like, meets this bartender dude mm-hmm. and he's like I haven't been with anyone, like, for real in, like, a long time, but I really like you, and they've yeah. spent, like, 20 minutes talking at that point.
Yeah.
And I was like, why is this in every movie? Like, I felt like that was intentional. I was like, why does this happen in every single movie, no matter what the movie is? Some guy is just like yeah. I feel like we really have a connection.
Yeah. I think, like, the fun part of that in this case is, like, she had literally one day before that just murdered a person.
Yeah.
So, like, in this story, and this dude is just like, I just think you're really soft and, like, yeah. really
Oh yeah,
sweet.
He likes her way more as Beth.
And it's just like, yeah, dude, sometimes just wait a while until you really get to know. They might have just murdered somebody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But also, hadn't she gone to that same bar?
Yeah,
they had been at that same bar, and
she was their waiter.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
the other guy,
and she was as Anne, and he didn't at all have that connection with her.
And then he was the guy when Anne was walking back. He was the guy in the truck
when Beth gave her a ride. Beth was walking.
Yeah. That's yeah. what I mean. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, the real Beth.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's something that I like about that dude, both as a writer and as an actor, is that in, like, all of his movies, he, like, makes himself out to be, like, kind of a dumb asshole. And it's, like, pretty willing to, like, steer into, like, self-critique. Like, he has his redeeming qualities, but in almost every movie, he's, like,
yeah.
pretty much a low-key or high-key misogynist.
Yeah. I took a vow of celibacy. Must rank really yeah, high that, on those that on the was, list of pickup I lines.
Took a vow of celibacy.
That was good. I mean, the whole party scene where he takes her to that, like, family party scene, I thought was actually, like, very good at being so oppressive. I don't know. I thought, like, the kids everywhere and, like, the dude being, like, this, like, very chill but, like, somehow also very, like, oppressive hippie dude. I don't yeah. know. You know, like, I liked his, like...
Yeah. And,
yeah, I really like the big dude who's Jane Addams' husband.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that whole scene, yeah, the fact great. that the other woman in that scene is the one who's sort of, like, interrogating her
oh,
in
yeah.
a weird way, where, like, she's interrogating her, but in the second person, so yeah. she's not asking her about herself, she's asking the guy about her, yeah. as if she's, like, not in the room.
Yeah.
And I was like, what a, like, weird way to, you know, like, lower somebody. Just be like, I'm yeah. gonna ask this person that I know about you, who I don't know.
While you're sitting there.
Yeah, while you're in the room, but we're just gonna pretend like you're not here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when they keep calling her sweetie in that first scene, like the opening scene, all of the, like, little...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to really, really like the movie based off the two audition scenes.
Yeah.
Because of how uncomfortable
yeah.
they were.
And yeah, like, those off voices were really good. Really
yeah. good. I was like, makes sense.
Jesus. So gross.
Well experienced in how uncomfortable this process is.
Yeah. No, it's like... This movie, you're going to be super naked in this movie. Not just really a little bit naked, real super naked.
It's like extensive.
And then like the other guys are like,
that we have these long shots. I would say it even trumps the uncomfortableness of the opening scenes of Girl 6, where Quentin Tarantino tells them, wants her name to take her top off. Remember the name of that?
I should really watch that movie.
Yeah, me too.
I'm getting that.
I want to just scream during this. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, we got to do these. It's like going to be long shots. Like, it's not, there's no quick cuts. So we can't use a body double. You are going to have to be naked.
The fact that he keeps saying sweet, he keeps saying like sweet.
And like, everyone keeps bringing it up. Like, later, they're like, why do you even care? Like, someone could Google you for like 30 seconds. They could find you naked everywhere.
When her boyfriend says that to her, it's like, I could just find any art film of you naked. And I was like, gross.
I bet there's like 100% chance that her actual husband said that to her at some point. And then he was like, wow, that was a really shitty thing for me to say. I'm going to write it into the shitty boyfriend's line. And she's like, that's a good way to process these feelings. Because, I mean, it's true. So, Sofia Tikal has been naked in, like, every single movie she's been in.
Wow. didn't she say she was, like, in, like, 10 times in 2 years? So, like, she's been in, like, 10 movies at least in 2 years?
Well,
yeah,
she's part of that, like, whole, like, Joe Swanberg, Alex Ross Perry, Pulaski, like, collective thing.
Yeah.
Like, all those actors just, you know, the way that they, like, get all those movies made, in a way, is that they're, like... I'm guessing part of the way is, you know, instead of like being able to pay like a lot of money to someone, it's like, all right, I can pay you this amount of money and I'll star in your film that you're making next month.
Right.
Yeah.
But I thought that the movie did a good job. Like, I liked the way that they set up, like they start off with those two like kind of interview shots of the two girls, even though it turns out the second one's not even an interview. But I thought that was a nice device, because then the rest of the movie, all like male characters feel like all women characters are like auditioning for them. Like, I don't know, that I thought that was good, and setting up that like atmosphere of like oppressive dudes and like, I don't know, I thought that making Hollywood's culture bleed into the rest of the life was very, I don't know, very good. But I'm still stuck on that. I think it could have been longer and done more of that.
Yeah, I think there was a point in the movie at which I think it's the part where they like run into the art director in the woods, where he's like, "Oh, I told her that I wanted you to be in this movie. She didn't tell you." That lands a little too on the nose for me, and then the movie kind of like accelerates from that point and like doesn't take the proper time for them to like process.
Yeah, so but I think feels, like,
well, yeah, it feels out of place like, with everything that's happened before.
There's like a heightened sense to the movie, which is not, I think what's a little bit off-putting is because maybe you're not even expecting this movie to have this sort of heightened sense, but like there's a lot of scenes that like they start playing out like a kind of a Swanberg-y kind of like conversation, let's see where this goes kind of scenes. But then like when this dude, this older dude is like flirting with them, and then he's like leaves.
He's going to the man convention.
Yeah.
Which is super men wrestle each other to figure out their problems. Yeah. I was like, is that clearly, real?
Like,
is
so it real? So deeply held, he like can't even talk about it really with her. He's like, no, it's really like, come on, like
yeah.
It's like, so don't give me a hard time about my man problems.
That's true. That's really funny. And like when he leaves, and then he starts flirting with Beth, and Anna sees him. She's just like in this like shot, and there's like loud music playing, and she's just like staring at her super angry, like, and it's just like, that would not play out like this regularly. Like, this movie is kind of playing with that. There's also the scene where they both bump into the other director guy, and then like it turns out that Beth like purposely didn't tell Anna about the fact that this guy wanted to cast her in one of his weird
avant-garde
shorts. Right. And then they like, she leaves. Like, Beth leaves, and then she's like, I'm just so sad about our friendship. It's just, like, also, like, kind of a weird thing to just say like that. And, like,
since the movie has been kind of, like, toying with it in an interesting way before that, like, they aren't explicitly saying it, but you're getting it from what they're saying.
Right.
And to have her, like, just out and out with it like that, it felt a little too much. Like the movie was just like, all right, now we're gonna hit this on the nose instead.
Phone calls are often like a device to like get that stuff done, and it's often hard to make them sound like anything other than like an expository dump. Yeah. There's like a scene at the beginning of another one of these films that I watched, was a Joe Swanberg one that I liked a fair amount, but starts off on a really wonky note where Jane Addams is Will, and she's just explaining to someone who I don't know if we ever see this character, that her niece is coming into town, and that her niece has an alcoholic father, and that, you know, she, like, you know, wants her to have a good life, but she wants to be an actress too, and she's worried about that, and I'm like, really? You're just gonna, like, drop all this information? I wasn't thinking about the time when I was watching it, but now I'm thinking about Margaret and the phone call scene and that, and how fucking good that scene is. Because like of how Kenneth Lonergan's like ability to like have like three different people in a scene who all are having the same conversation but different ones at the same time.
Yeah. Yes.
Where like Anna Paquin's character is like just trying to like vent or like connect with her dad, and she's like super sad about this thing, and he's like worried about it from a legal standpoint, and then his girlfriend or new wife or whatever like comes in and like starts asking them about this trip that they're gonna take, that, you know, like the stuff needs to get, she doesn't realize that she's being rude, but you know that's because she doesn't realize that the two of them are talking about a dead person on the phone, and he's like, can you just hold on? Like, it's so rare that phone calls I think land for me that sound realistic, that sound,
I mean, the phone call in this movie, you know, I thought was exactly that. Such a dump when she's talking to her boyfriend. She, like, really just, like, lets it out. But the best thing about it was that it was, I mean, I like that device where it moves back and forth and then she's in the last shot. Which, again, I almost thought she could have done a little, I don't know, that didn't land as hard as I think it even could have. But I thought it was cool. It looked nice.
I kept expecting the guy to be in the background who just driven her to the house.
Oh, yeah. That's,
like, just breaking into the house. But, like,
yeah.
And then and then those two suddenly having to fight this guy. That would have been funny, too.
That's what I was kind of, I was half expecting that long. As soon as he was the waiter, I felt creeped out.
I was actually kind of hoping that it was a misdirect, like, that was trying to, like, lead me to this thing where it's like, oh, they're going to have this fight because, like, that's what it's building to. I was kind of hoping that it was actually, like, a misdirect, like a classic, like, horror twist where it's like, oh, the twist is now they have to work together or whatever.
And,
like,
I was like,
it would have been funny for this movie to, like turn into kind of a dumb horror movie. Like it kind of,
I was hoping, oh, wow, that would be, like, really interesting for it to be, like, this, you know, kind of talky movie for that long, and then just, like, twist and just be like, now it's a horror, now it's like a, you know, because, like, a survival movie,
because,
like,
they keep talking about the dumb horror movies that she keeps starring in.
Probably says something about me that's not good, but for some reason I thought that they were gonna be gay.
I was totally
like, there were, they, like, never, I really thought that, like, that was part of the conflict, was that
they were attracted to each other.
Yeah, is that they were, like, a little bit attracted to each other, but unwilling to, like, follow through on it. And then it never really comes up in, like, a meaningful way. It made me sad.
I never got that sense. I don't know.
I thought they got that tension really well, like, in the
beginning. I agree. Like,
and,
like, the shower scenes and, like, I don't know. There was just, like, something. Like,
that was...
Yeah, like, they felt a little more like exes than they did, like, longtime friends.
Yeah,
true. That was, like...
Right.
To me, I don't know.
Yeah, very... open wound kind of, like, energy.
Yeah, true.
Well, I'm glad I'm not totally alone as that's concerned. And there's shots, like, in the, like, little brief intercutting sections, there's these shots of, like, the two of them, like, writhing on top of someone, but then it doesn't show who it is, and for some reason I was, like, associating that with, like, some sort of
them too
subconscious desire to fuck each other.
I mean, I don't know,
one or two attractive people alone in the woods in a big
it's like you can't help but think, you know?
I want everything to be gayer.
I know
movies can be, like, super gay, and I could still be happy if they were gayer than they already are.
I'm
super upset that Wonder Woman is like the straightest fucking movie.
That makes me sad. Yeah, that makes like, me not that excited to watch it.
Yeah,
it's probably. Not a single gay thing about that movie. On an island full of women, and then Chris Pine is like friends with all these like, you know, rapscallion dudes, and I was like, nothing.
No,
like,
it sounds really
not just like a little
subtext.
Sounds really gay.
Yeah. I hope Star Trek 4, if they make another one, is just him and Zachary Quinto just having sex for like an hour and a half. Yeah.
Chris Pine would be like a great dude in like a movie about like a huge 70s 80s disco club. He would be so good at it. Just his fucking I would love hair to see and everything.
Chris Pine is like awesome. Dating a woman and so the whole like the whole first act people are just like, oh, he's the straight guy dating a woman, but then he's actually just a bi dude, and just like at the end of the first act is him just fucking like a dude.
Yeah,
real hard.
It'd be good for the world.
We could sell people on that idea. I think
there's a script there. Yeah.
Just need to sell Chris Pine on it.
It's just Chris Pine.
I think I could sell him first before I could sell directors and producers on it.
That's my script idea. It's just Chris Pine fucking a lot of dudes. Just straight. It's a remake of Stranger by the Lake, but it's all the characters.
Oh my god.
Chris Pine with all the other characters.
Oh, who would the mustache dude be?
James Marsden, who's like the older Chris Pine. He's like the older, like even more self-aware Chris
James
Pine.
Marsden.
Zac Efron must be in that movie.
Zac Efron. Zac Efron's more for that, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
How about Zac Efron be the like weird cop who shows up?
No, he's like the masturbator guy. He's like the guy who's masturbating.
Yeah. Hollywood's really like primed for this remake. Like they really need to get on it before somebody like gains some weight or something. Yeah.
Hollywood, when are you gonna give the people what they want? Jesus.
But even the murder scene in this movie in like Always Shine, I thought was like a little sexualized. Partly because it was like away, I don't know, the noises, like I don't know.
Plus choking.
Anytime you have a person laying on top of another person,
struggling, you know,
I thought that scene
choking
was
is like the hip kink these days. Yeah, that's what all the millennial kids are into is choke me, daddy.
Right.
I have to say, I wonder what this says about me, but actually, a lot of that scene was really funny to me. Like there was when they because the movie started cutting really weird when she like when Anna starts running after Beth. And then it like cuts to this long shot, and then like these woods, and then you kind of hear them like wah, kind of like they're like squealing a little bit, like they're not like you know it's a bit like it sounds kind of hammy, like it's a bit weird, and it's just like keeps cutting back and back and back until it's just like this huge like swath of land, and you're just like in the back like. Wah. It's been weird.
I can't claim any sort of like knowledge of like directorial intention, but I don't think that Sofia Takala is like Anna Biller, and that like she feels like you have to respond a certain way to how she makes like her scenes, like just because of how willing they are, both in her and her husband. I think his name is Lawrence Michael Levine. I've forgotten.
I think that sounds right.
Their films, how they're willing to play like. Very different scenes, like switch on a dime, like how seriously you are supposed to take a scene or something like that.
Right.
Like in one of the movies that I just watched, they're like, this is like really uncomfortable moment where he steps on her hamster and like you see it coming from like a mile away and it's like really uncomfortable and unpleasant because you see it like it's going to happen and it happens and it's like she's like screaming at him and is really upset and then they decide that they have to put the hamster down and they put the hamster like in a jar and then turn on a car and put it on the exhaust pipe and put it out of its misery and I started laughing uncomfortably and then murdering this hamster and I'm like this hamster funeral for it and I was like what the fuck and like I feel like they're pretty much okay with that.
No, I think that's some of the best. Like when I remember now, like when she's leaving that guy's car, when she like leaves with like without saying goodbye.
Yeah,
she's kind of half running into the house, but it's like the way she does it, it's like this weird like trot.
She's like, runs really, but it's like the kind of thing I think you do when you're kind of scared and you don't know whether you should be scared, and you're kind of like half, like, I don't know. Like,
it's like the least like actiony scene that you usually maybe be in that context, where she's just like jumping out of the car, like running out of it, and like the camera would be right behind her. Instead of just like this log, she's just like, it takes a while until she's up there.
Yeah, and you're kind of like embarrassed for like her, the way she's moving. She's like kind of half sidling, like, I don't know. It's like,
this only very slightly related has to do with running, has to do with Vassar. But I used to, always made me feel bad when I saw people who were like late for class or something like that, and they were like running to class, but they weren't in good shape. So they would run like 100 yards and then they would stop. And they would walk like the next, like, you know, 500 yards. And I was like, why did you even like run the first 100 yards? You knew you couldn't make it the whole way to the building.
It's so sad, like with backpacks on and like, you know, it's just like so awkward.
Running with a backpack is the worst.
Like running in an airport, you know, it's just like you're always tangling and like, oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, I one time my family's like connection to a plane was late, and I was wearing clogs, and I tried to like run to the all the way down the hangar, because you know my family's older, none of them could run, so I just took off to see if I could catch the plane before it left, if they would hold it for us. But the doors were already closed when I got there. Damn clogs.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it goes. No, it's never worth it when you're running in an airport. God. What do you think of the music? I mean, I agree that the music was a little ham-handed, you know, like a little over the top.
I liked it.
Well, you liked it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too, but it was like, it was on the nose sometimes, but I liked it. I thought it was cool. I don't know.
I didn't even really notice the music in this movie, honestly.
I noticed it.
Yeah, it's a little like that, but it was a good, like, you know, the talented musicians and composer.
I think. I mean, I guess I kind of like, I got the vibe it wanted me to get from it.
Yeah.
I guess it was sort of like horror music vibe.
Yeah, very
horror. Genre films with really loud, obstructive music is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
Because normally that type of score, really, I really don't like it.
No.
Like, it dulled my enjoyment of Under the Skin and Ex Machina, which are two films that I like a lot.
Yeah.
That have a similar sort of, like, loud, obtrusive score.
Oh, yeah.
I still like that Under the Skin score.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Under the Skin.
I also like the one that Michael Levy did for Jackie, too.
Yeah.
Even though I never actually saw that movie, but I listened to the soundtrack.
But like, Mitchell said that it's the same thing on the podcast, because I was complaining about some other movie having a score like that, and he was like, just like Jackie. I haven't watched it. I think I am going to watch it, though.
Yeah. I probably will, too.
I don't really have that many more notes. It was, you know, kind of a... It was obviously, like, fairly short film. I do have this one thing, which is, it's not a, I guess, like, a lot of this movie is about, you know, women actors, but there was one thing that I feel like is a general actor complaint that she buried in there, made me laugh, because I thought of, when Judy Greer was on, You Made It Weird, I think is where I heard her complain about this, because Judy Greer has been in, like, so many things, like, she constantly gets people to walk up to her and be like, what have I seen you in?
Yeah. Oh, God, that scene was horrible.
She's not like Cameron Diaz or whatever. Yeah. It's like, well, what have I seen you in? And she's like, do you want me to list like my 115 IMDb credits? I don't know what the fuck you've seen me in. I think it was You Made It Weird, right? Judy Greer was talking about that, and I was like, it would be even worse for Judy Greer than it would be for like these two women, because she's probably only been like 15 things.
Yeah.
So far, but like
that is a horror. Yeah, that scene was excellent and so grating. Yeah,
that's what's her name, Colleen Camp, who also shows up in Knock Knock.
Nice, another connection.
She's the what was the movie that Knock Knock was a remake of? Because she's the one of the actresses in the original version.
I didn't even know it was a remake.
It's like called like
Death No
Game
Idea
or something.
Death Game.
I don't think that's the actual title, but it's the same idea. Home invasion with two women show up and torment a man. She's one of the
women. I thought it was like they were playing Sorry and
Yeah.
Oh no, you get bumped off the board, you die.
They do play a game in Knock Knock. It's called Who Wants to Kill a Pedophile? It's a pretty good game. I like it.
All right, guys, I'm gonna go. So,
we'll miss you.
Bye, dear listeners.
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye. Dipping.
Yeah, I think the only other note that I had is when Anna is giving her audition scene. There's she's arguing with like a mechanic about something in her audition scene, and then it cuts to her. Like just paying a mechanic in real life money, yeah. And I was like, the difference between women on screen and women in real life is they just have to accept whatever shitty behavior is being thrown at them. It's like a nice, real strong cut to imply that.
I thought that was excellent. I guess the only other note, I was like thinking, I guess we should talk about the end, even though you're so right that it was just like not an ending. And I guess since I finished the movie at like 10:30 this morning, I've been trying to think of something to say about the ending and not really hitting on anything.
Like, this will be a surprise maybe when Ilya listens to this podcast, but I was, until the ending, I was confused as to like whether or not she definitely for sure murdered her.
Oh.
Everyone was like, in the podcast, everyone has been like, oh yeah, she murdered her.
Okay.
And they're like, but like, to me, until like the end, I was like, oh, was she like maybe someone who died a long time ago, or like did she ever exist? Are they two parts of the same person, like a persona type deal, or you know? And like,
so that really was
the ending is like ambiguous, but it actually sort of closes off other avenues of ambiguity.
I thought she'd murdered her, but then I was like, but the things you just said, some of those were floating around in my head the whole time. And I agree that the end sort of like more closes off the ambiguity, which I think I'm coming down on the side of, kind of wish, especially now we're talking about it, that they left the ambiguity, because I think, again, I still think that last 30 minutes was the most interesting part of the movie, and part of it was that ambiguity there, and I kind of wish they just like sat with that.
I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I like Sofia Tichol a lot as an actress, and I think she's going in an interesting direction.
Mm-hmm.
As a director, I don't know if I like her influences that much, but I like her better than them, so I feel like maybe she'll make one of these movies and I'll really like it, even though it's not the type of thing that I'm generally into.
Mm.
But definitely, to me, the better version of this movie, where the sort of like a little bit of the one-notedness of the acting performances in the first half makes more sense to me, is that, you know, there never was an Anne or Anna.
Right.
That there's only Beth.
Right.
And that these are two parts of her struggling with like different parts of her life. And you know, like it also sort of makes like lines like where Anna, I don't know, this says like, do you ever feel whorish about that?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Do you ever feel like land, a whore? Yeah.
Yeah. It would make it feel. It would make it land a lot more if like, in a way, she was saying that to herself, as opposed to her friend saying it to her.
Right.
Yeah.
Although, actually, I thought that line was so, you know, so much. But then I did actually really like it being two people for Beth's response, which was, she was like, yeah, kind of sometimes. I don't know. That was like something, but again, maybe just unrealistic. But I felt like I actually kind of, that kind of hit me, like the idea of, there's a lot of, these are very self-reflective characters, I guess. And even in the second half, like Anna's like really feeling like a lot of guilt for something. But like, that Beth would like say that and still be wounded. I don't know, that I like that, but it wasn't worth the ham-handed stupid question. Like, it's too much. I don't know.
I kind of wish the movie had ended when they're like having the memory of the fight in the woods, and then just the clapper comes in the middle of the scene.
I love that. That was excellent.
I was like, I would just wish there had been credits.
I was even waiting for like a, I was like so excited for like a Taste of Cherry moment where like it just pulls back and there's the crew, and then it like gets really uncomfortable because like they're just like, hot, like great work, you know, so nice to work with you, like you're really good, like you're really good, you look really pretty.
That would actually been a really funny, super uncomfortable way to end the movie.
So uncomfortable.
The two of them sitting in those like director's chairs, like the two actresses sitting and just throwing like a bunch of fake praise at each other,
like, you know what I mean, like that would have been like, I mean, you know, you can get too meta, but like that would have been that. Like, made, just even that clapper made me very uncomfortable.
In a good way. But yeah, you know, I guess tying it up. I mean, I in general like the idea that there's this, you know, not particularly low key misogyny in film, and that these women who, you know, are barely like, neither of them are particularly successful, are still like taught to like, you know, destroy each other. I think it's a much better version of some of the things that Wendy Refn was trying to say in The Neon Demon. But he lacks any nuance to say them, so.
Agreed.
All right. Do y'all want to move on to heralds and announcements?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
Time, no, before we do that, let's do this, because we did that, so now we do this. And Patrick, do you have anything you would like to herald or denounce?
Well, I actually want to, I'm going to herald a movie that I watched while we were waiting for you to get to your parents' house. Well, in between takes, I watched a like 39-minute movie called Elephant, directed by Alan Clark from 1989. Oh. It's, I believe the, yeah, it's, I believe the movie that Gus Van Sant was actually inspired by when he made his movie called Elephant.
It's not a remake, but it's like a spiritual remake.
Yeah, yeah. It's, both it's, about it's very similar in theme. Yeah, it's just people walking to places and shooting people.
Oh, wow.
It's all of the context is completely removed. You don't know who any of the characters are.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think you even see any of the characters again after they're seen. So it's just, cool. And I believe it takes place all in Northern Ireland, if I'm remembering the description correctly. So it's all just people being shot, and you don't know why, you don't know who they are, you don't know what they mean in the context of anything. It's just the killing itself. Oh, just like the act of killing itself, and it's a pretty like. What I found most interesting was, like, eventually I actually started getting bored with it, and I was like, oh my god, this is, like, exactly the way that violence works in the real world, too. Like, in the news, you just hear, you know, 50 people were killed in a car bomb in this place or whatever, and you're just like, I can't even care about it anymore. It just happens all the time now. And I was like, oh my god, like, I'm watching this movie that's not even, you know, like, an hour long, and I can't even focus long enough to, like, continue caring about the people that are being killed, you know? And it's just like, wow, like, it's amazing how fast it, like, goes smooth on you. You know, just, like, it's like, violence, 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 and you're just like, okay. You're just like, I can't even focus on the act anymore. Like, it's just a thing that happens, and you're just like, well, you know, and especially like it being completely divorced from context, like, makes it, I don't know, that much more like anonymous, because you're just like, I don't even know what any of it means, you know. And a lot of the times that's the way stuff feels the first, like, as soon as it happens, you're just like trying to make sense of it, and, you know, without the context here, it's just like, you know, I don't know what any of it means. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's a pretty interesting little film. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it.
Oh yeah, I definitely do. That sounds awesome.
I do
want to
watch it. Probably not this year though. Maybe soon.
Mm-hmm. Full docket.
Would you like to herald or denounce something, Colin?
Sure, yeah. I've got a herald watched recently, and I keep, for some reason, cannot keep the name in my head of The Reckless Moment. I guess because the name, I don't know, for some reason feels divorced from the movie itself, but it's an Ophuls, Max Ophuls movie. We
like that dude.
Ah,
Bubbles is good.
I really, yeah, I'd forgotten how much I love that dude. He's really amazing. I mean, you know, it's the same all, you know, swooping crazy long shots with so much movement in and out of them, and like vertical and horizontal. It's just like the camera is just does things that you just kind of forget that it can do. And then also the acting is amazing. I think it's Greer Garson's the main. She's like the mother of this teenager who like gets involved with like this kind of thuggish character, and then she like gets in a fight in her family's boathouse with this thuggish like older man, and pushes him and he dies basically. And then Greer Garson's her mother, who kind of like basically like hides the murder and like is sort of like being pursued by a blackmailer played by a young James Mason, who is so hot in it, it's like crazy. He's like tall, handsome, brooding Irishman with like his like snake voice, and it's just like he's so. And so Greer Garson's husband's like away, you never see him, he's like abroad doing business, and she's like dealing with this huge family that's all on her back and hiding this murder, and like James Mason's blackmailing her, but then they like slowly and like awesomely like start to kind of build this relationship that's like clearly somewhat based on love, but like also like the blackmail. It's like so complex and awesome and like creepy and moves so fast, and you just feel like life crushing Greer Garson, who like plays it so well, this like tight, like very controlled, yeah, like always smoking, but like that's the only sign of like any, I don't know, like a really interesting flip on femme fatale, because she's like taking hold, she's like the house taking housewife to this like crazy degree, and James Mason's like, I don't know, there's like all these like funny, like everyone that meets her is like, everyone's like, oh, like you're Mrs. like, I thought you were the teenager, like you're much hotter than I expected, all these dudes like, and she's just like, get on with it, like what do I have to do to get you off my back, like, you know, whatever, like it's just like so good. Man, I was like really, anyway, also like short and just like so like, you know, builds to like this crazy climax, and anyway, I can't recommend it enough. Just like blew me away.
Yeah, that's what I always associate with that dude is excellent women characters,
right,
with great performances.
Right.
Of course, the lead in Earrings of Madame Du, right, but there's another one that I even prefer the lead performance. I don't know if I prefer the movie. I like them about the same, which is a lot. What's it called?
Lola Montez? Well,
yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I want to see that so the, bad now. Yeah.
She's in the... Yeah. In the circus, and it's like all about how when you, and this is a similar thing to what we just talked about, it's all about how when you're a woman performer, how that life isn't that different from your regular life because you spend all of your time having men look at you anyways.
God.
And tell you how to act.
Ophuls is crazy. Like,
yeah, no, it's always like, we keep saying this on the podcast, but it's like one of those things where it feels prescient because nothing has changed in 70 years.
Oh, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. It's like it's really ahead of his time. It's like, oh wait, no, like no.
I was doing a bit of like looking it up while you were talking about that movie. Apparently, it's not Greer Garson though. Apparently.
I knew I had the actress wrong.
Yeah, I think it's Joan Bennett. I believe.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah, I was looking. Yeah. You're correct though. They look very similar. So I looked up Greer Garson. I was like, oh yeah, she does look very similar to Joan Bennett.
Yeah, they confused me. Different
British actress or yeah. English actress.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, yeah, Joan Bennett. Awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess we're on the positivity train this week because it's going to be a all Harold slate. I have a lot of things that I could talk about, but the one I'm going to choose to talk about is The Secret World of Arrietty, which is, I don't remember the director, but it's one of those Studio Ghibli films. Mm-hmm. And it was, at the time, dismissed as being just like kind of a cutesy, like not as good My Neighbor Totoro, because it involves a lot of the same things, which is like, you know, mystical creatures in this case who I guess are just small humans, and like a sick person.
Yeah, it's the borrowers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The borrowers.
Yeah, the borrowers.
Borrowers, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And I mean, beyond the things which you might expect from Studio Ghibli, which are true of this film, just like most of their films, it's very pretty to look at and has really great music. I actually think it's a pretty sly indictment of capitalism. And like really just like slipped it in there in a way that like I feel like a lot of people just weren't paying attention to, which makes me kind of sad because I thought like, you know, when I came out of the movie, like I, you know, someone who didn't see it with me was like, oh, did you like that movie? Here's just like a bunch of cutesy fluff. And I was like, I didn't feel that way about it at all. In fact, one of the things that clued me in is the fact that they're called the borrowers and all they do is steal. They hardly ever borrow anything whatsoever. And it's very important to them that they call themselves the borrowers because
of thieves.
What they're literally doing is stealing. What they're stealing is so insignificant to these people. It means so little to them because they need so little from this house. Like, that the people who call them thieves, who like, you stole one sugar cube from us. That's what your whole week's worth of sugar is, one sugar cube. But you're a thief, and we're going to catch you for having done that. And to me, it just like, and there's this beautiful dollhouse that they have in the house that the borrowers could live in, but they're afraid of the humans, and so they don't live. It's just this house sitting there, not being used. This beautiful home that's been built for no reason. And I was like, no one is getting anything from this. Maybe about like that whole real estate bubble thing when they were just building houses and now they're just sitting there disused. The people can't use them because we're unwilling to just give them away for free even though they exist,
right? To be used.
And yeah, there's this great scene when like you know, the movie is kind of about like a little bit of a burgeoning friendship between Arietti and then the sick boy whose name is Sho. And the first time that they really have like a conversation, like she's talking about how, you know, they only know one other borrower in the film and they don't know how many exist in the world. And he's like, there are 6.7 billion people. And he's like, your people, he's like, if there's not that many of them, they're probably going to go extinct. And he's just like saying these things like really crudely and casually to her. And just being like, he's like, you know, environments change and then creatures go extinct. And I'm like, is someone going to call him out on that? And I was, thankfully she did. She's like, my environment didn't change. You changed it. Humans, we have to leave because of what you did. She's like, those species that went extinct. She doesn't say this part, but she thought species that went extinct, that was you. That was humans. And I was like, really? What? Why do people think this is just like a cutesy family movie? I don't know. I guess because the ending is like kind of like one of those like beats where like Sho is like saying goodbye because the borrowers have to leave. They can't stay in that home anymore. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you've given me the courage to like try to live or something like that. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I understand, but that moment still hit for me in a way because like the courage that he's given, that she's given him is like, she actually like understands the world and like I don't know all the awful things that people can do. I would say that like my major complaint about it, the only thing that really kept me from giving it a 5-star rating actually, is that it has some like kind of stock Studio Ghibli characters who I'm just like, you know,
yeah, of course,
are just not good. Arietti is an interesting character and Sho is kind of interesting, but the Arietti's mother is just like your very typical like kind of shrill, constantly terrified like housewife. Who's just like, you know, every time she hears that anything went wrong, it's just like her hair stands up all on end. And then like her dad, of course, is like, you know, a gruff but fair like silent dude who's like looking out for the family. And then of course the villain of the piece is like the maid, and she's like just super evil, but like we don't really know why. There's a really horrendous scene where she finds the mother, where she finds the borrowers, and she like first she like picks her up and she like pulls this like teapot like out of her hands, and you can like see it like happening, like feels like it's in slow motion. It's just something is just being like ripped from her hands, and then she like puts her in a glass, and I'm just like, ah, this is like one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen. Like, I don't want to watch this anymore. But yeah, it was my favorite movie that I watched over the last 2 weeks, and probably one of
interesting. That director, Hiromasa Yonebayashi, actually has a movie coming out this year called Mary and the Witch's Flower. So look for that.
Put it on the watch list.
Put it on the watch list. Although I think it's with a different studio. Actually, it's with a studio called Ponak. I don't know how you say that exactly.
Yeah, but, Studio Ghibli, I believe, is in hibernation right now as they figure out what they want to do.
Yeah.
I think when Hayao Miyazaki retired, they released like one film and then they're like, oops, we have no idea what we're doing.
he was talking about like coming back to make more movies. So it's I don't know. And somebody drew a really funny comic where it was Miyazaki and he was a cat and he was like, yeah, I'm retiring, and he walks out the door, he's like, just kidding, I'm back, and he's like, this cat is like who won't go out the door and stay. It's like, that's very funny. Miyazaki is a cat who can't decide what he wants to do. I've seen that movie and I did not pick up on any of that because I was doing something else at the time.
I'm going to guess that we should say callback to the autobiographical canon in which Patrick said that Studio Ghibli films are an aphrodisiac for nerds.
Yep. The old Miyazaki and chill.
One of the great moments on this podcast.
That's true.
Alright, this is normally when we end it, so I don't have a cute way to transition into it, but sure. If you are enjoying this podcast like we enjoyed those movies, you should subscribe using your podcast listening application, give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, and check out the rest of our content, which you can find on loosecannons.net. That's canon, canons.net, where you can find all of our podcasts as well as our writings and our videos. And if you'd like to participate in a conversation with us about any of these films or anything relating to anything, we have a message board now,
literally
which you can find through the website, and also Patrick knows the
it is Loose URL. Cannons, yeah, it's loosecannonspodcast.boards.net.
Yep.
So
you can discuss anything you want with us there, and if you have any questions or comments, you can send it to our email address, loosecannonspodcast@gmail.com, and we will answer it as long as it's not like super racist or something. And if it's a really interesting question, we will we'll answer it on air. So
woo!
Do that.
Right on for interesting questions.
Thanks again for listening, and thank you, Colin, for joining us. Great having you again.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, glad to be here.
All right. Bye, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
I think we nailed it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Nailed it.
Yeah.